Welcome to the Irish Photography Podcast. Take control of your camera and develop the skills necessary to improve and master your photography. Join me, Dermot O'Donovan, John Myler and Darren J. Spoonley as they cut through the sometimes confusing jargon of photography to help you find your own style and decide what's best for you. A mix of educational, inspirational, honest and sometimes controversial content delivered in a unique, fun way from three of Ireland's talented photographers. Let's go.
Hello and welcome to another episode from the Irish Photography Podcast. And again, as every week, I am joined by my two pals, Darren J. Spoonley and Dermot O'Donovan. How are you doing, boys?
Great. How are you?
Good stuff. Oh, jeez. Good. I cut across you, Darren. I'm so apologetic.
That's no problem. Really, that's no problem.
Anyway, I'm
lads, go on, listen to me for a sec, lads. Now, you're cutting across me, dog. Jesus.
I'm on fire.
You're on fire. Calm down, boy. Listen, I tell you guys, tonight we're going to discuss two different topics, and I'm hoping you can help me out with them, right? One being astrophotography for the beginner. All right, so I want us to look at this from the sense of somebody who is just took up their journey in photography and wants to take that lovely Milky Way photograph, and how we can advise somebody how to take that photograph, both from our experience and the past and to date, okay? And that's going to be followed then by street photography. And would I be right in saying that street photography is something that you boys don't really do?
Does that answer everything?
Yeah. What about you, Darren?
I don't really do it, but actually I did try once, and I think I got a nice shot. I'll throw it up on the Facebook group. But yeah, I haven't. It's not something I do quite often.
Yeah, it is. It's a difficult one. That's why I wanted to. We'll discuss that later on, and I'll give you my thoughts on it. But first of all, lads, we're going to jump straight into the astrophotography, okay? And it's something that I really like to do. Now, I by no means wouldn't call myself an expert, okay? Because I think to be an expert in something, you have to be doing it on a regular basis and be pulling out these super images. But do you know what? In the past, I've pulled out some nice shots of the night sky, predominantly the Milky Way. I would look at the astrophotography in two different styles. We can look at it with a long exposure showing the stars streaking across the sky in amazing circles, which is basically your star trails. Or we can look at it as a long exposure, but shorter, which has enabled us to capture the beautiful Milky Way in the galaxy. Now, the first one, being the star trails, is something that I have not done that often, being honest with you. Have any of you guys done star trails photography?
Me, personally, I have done it by accident. And that's when I was just a novice of photography and learning about astrophotography. And I didn't realize what I had done. Now, I was slightly overexposed, but yeah, I did, in essential, kind of do it, but by accident.
Yeah. What about you, Darren? Have you ever tried star trail as in a full star trail?
No, I haven't. Although I know that you have tasked me in a previous episode of this podcast to do one, so it's still on my list to do. But it's not something that I would have ever thought of doing, to be honest with you, because I think there's obviously a lot of work involved in it. You have to know a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, from a star trail point of view, you mentioned something interesting there. Is circles in the sky. And you know, if we're talking in regards to a beginner, a circle in the sky will only work is when you're pointing directly at the North Star. And that's you have to know where the North Star is. And I remember years ago, a friend of mine got a telescope from the US. He went on holidays to the US, came back with his telescope, was all excited about the telescope. And one of the first things that you had to do was find the North Star. And we couldn't even do that. So we could never really use the telescope. So, you know, I think to say that you can do these things easily, you have to know how to find the North Star. And I'm sure we'll touch on that during this topic. But long story short, No, I've never done that.
But I'll tell you what, sorry there, Dermot. For tonight, guys, what we're going to do is we're more going to look at the Milky Way photograph. Okay, how to photograph the Milky Way, because I would like us to do in another podcast down the line, which probably be part two to this podcast, when we're going to look at the star trail photography, and hopefully we'll have a guest speaker come in who does this on a regular basis and can give us a full detail on actually the process of getting a star trail photograph and other night sky objects.
Great. Looking forward to that. That'll be fun.
That's the plan. So hopefully the plan will work out. Dad, I cut across you there. My apologies. What were you going to say there?
No, it's just in relation to the North Star, and it just got me thinking there. it really is the center of attention of everything in astrophotography, really. Like, if you think about it, the those star trackers that you can buy, they have to be calibrated towards the North Star before you can even use it also. Otherwise, the timing of the tracker and tracking the stars obviously won't work. And I've just listened to other podcasts before on when they were using them, and they've had problems with that. And as well as you, Darren, they couldn't even find the North Star, and that was part of the problem. So one girl just freaked out and called it a piece of crap and threw it in the bin.
I'm glad I'm not alone on that one, so I'm not being able to find the North Star. I can find it now, but I couldn't find it then.
Okay, well, like, that's something we'll come back to, boys. But for now, I remember when I got into my photography journey, and I used to be looking at social media on Facebook, and it went through a phase there on Flickr, and I was searching all these beautiful photographs of the Milky Way, and like, they're stunning, some stunning images out there. But I never thought I'd actually be able to take a photograph of the Milky Way, and that's being honest with you. You know, I was out shooting the landscape, shooting this, that, and the other, but I often wondered, what does it take to actually photograph the Milky Way? And really, it doesn't take that much. I have taken my Milky Way photographs with my 60D, which is a crop sense camera. But when I did upgrade to my full frame camera, my 6D, it was a whole new ball game, because they're so great with low light sensitivity and so on. But that doesn't mean you can't take a photograph using a point and shoot camera. Like, there are entry level cameras there that we can use to take the photographs of the Milky Way, but it's just knowing the correct settings, the exposures and so on that we need to do that.
Basically, you need to have full manual control of a camera. So if you can't, you obviously can't do it with an iPhone, or if you have a bridge camera, you need to have manual settings that you can dial in, correct?
You need to be able to control your exposure and time. Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
Okay, just so the listeners know exactly where they are.
Yeah. Lens as well have the big, big role to play in that. I did shoot the Milky Way with a 16-35 2.8 lens, which was wide open. Now, I sold that to a good pal of mine. Isn't that right, Dermot?
Me!
And the reason I sold that was because I actually wasn't using that. You know, I went through a year. I don't think I took that out of my desk to shoot it. And that's because the elements weren't coming together. So I got rid of that. And I am hoping to replace that now with a... Darren, what's the lens that you have for shooting your Astro?
It's a Tokina 11-16.
Tokina,
it's really, really good. But it's not for a full frame camera, so at 16 mil it will work, but at 11 it won't, so I'll get vignetting. But it's the lens I use from an astrophotography point of view. I had it when I had my previous crop sensor, which is a 70D, and it was phenomenal. It actually opened up the world to me, well, the night world, because exactly as you say, you know, from the beginner point of view, they have to have full manual control of the camera, but they also have to understand aperture. So 2.8 or even lower, 1.4, 1.2, yes. I think, as well. You know, that the wider and more light that you can let in, the better it's going to be. So if you have a f4, it won't allow much light in, so you won't be able to get a proper exposure. So the Tokina, for me, is a phenomenally good lens. And I'll tell you one thing, actually, that I really love about the Tokina, and I think it's the only lens that has this, is finding infinity. So if we look at Canon lenses, you know, you'll go to infinity, what it says on the actual lens itself, but typically it's never exactly where it says it is on the lens. It's always a slight bit back. But with the Tokina, it's simple. If you switch it all the way over, that is infinity. I never have to mess around with trying to find focus. And I'm sure you'll probably discuss that in a moment. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But I never have to mess around with that. Whereas I see others when I go shooting for in the night sky, and they have to find different ways to find infinity. Whereas with the Tokina, it was bang, it was done. Brilliant lens, but like I say, from the 11, it doesn't work. It works at 16.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and you are correct when you say about your infinity, and I will be touching on that in a second when we come down to the basic settings for it. But I suppose one of the other the must needs for anybody who's thinking of starting out to get some astrophotography images is it's slow and steady. And what I mean by slow and steady is a tripod is essential.
Oh,
I'm sure you'll both agree on that.
Well, you know, look, without a doubt. I mean, even Superman couldn't stand still for 25 seconds.
You know, and also the ground that you're standing on. Like, you could have your tripod, but your surface needs to be quite stable too. And that reminds me Dermot, remember when we were up in the Milky Way, we spoke about this in our first podcast when we shot the Milky Way up by O'Brien's Tower up in the Cliffs of Moher.
Yeah, there was soft grass there, so it's like kind of sea pink's grass, so that's soft and bouncy, so you have to be very careful there.
You have to be very careful, but you also remember we went around to the backside and we were shooting the tower, and we were getting these lovely images. The night sky was great, but yet the tower itself came across as being slightly soft. Mm. And it was only after a number of shots, actually, Dermot, I think it was after about 10 minutes, we discovered that the slabs that our tripods were on were ever so loose. So when we were taking our photograph, when we stepped away from our camera, we were actually moving the slab under our feet without realizing it, which in turn was throwing off the tripod, which was giving us a slightly blurred image. And that was why it took us a while before we learned that lesson, and then we were able to mess around with that and get our sharper shot.
That's a brilliant point.
Yeah.
That's actually a brilliant point.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So really you have to be more mindful of the air you're in and what you're standing on. So slow and steady all the way. Light the way. And what I mean by lighting the way is we all need a good head torch when we're out there. Now, I have gone out like that at the night time with my big white bright light, and it's been great. But after talking to some guys who are big into their astrophotography, and more so the astro as in their telescopes or planets and so on, I now use my red light. Now, there's probably a term for that. I don't know what it's called. But I use a red light, which is a feature on my headlamp, which allows my eyes to stay focused on the night sky. So, but yet I can see the controls on the back of my camera. Does that make sense to you guys?
Oh, definitely. Sure. It's common sense. Like, the big bright light is going to startle your eyes and it's going to disturb the image, whereas a red light, it's a lot less lumens first and foremost. And
ooh, look at you with those big words.
So it's not picked up on the camera either. It's just a red light and it's very dimmable, so it's exactly. not and it's not disturbing other photographers either.
Yes, that's because a very, very valid point. Yes,
you know, like, I've been at plenty of photography trips, and there's always some plonker there with light. I was going to say the guy's name that I went to Kerry with one time. He drives me nuts. And he was there with his big flashlight, flashing ever. Everyone was ready to knock the head off him. Sorry, no, that's the limerick coming out of me now. I'm getting very passionate here. yeah, he just ruined everyone's image there for about 10 minutes. And then we just had to literally say to him, cop the hell on, like, you know, so.
Yeah, no, it does. The light's very important. Like that, I would recommend anybody starting off, you can buy lights out there now that have the red light feature. And then when you turn off your red light, you can still see the skies, the night sky, just as good if you were had no light on for a little bit of time. Planning is a huge thing, as we all know. Planning in photography, all aspects of photography, be it landscape, macro, anything, planning is very, very important. And some of us, it's not our strengths.
Oh, I totally agree. Planning is very important, guys. You should always do planning. I always do planning.
And planning is not your strength.
the only planning you do is to send either me or John a message and go, I must send them a message to find out when's the right time to go shooting the sky.
Exactly. Do you know what? The only thing I ever plan, and I'm very meticulous about it, is when I'm shooting a wedding. And that's the only time I plan the whole day out. But other than that, I just wait for you to do the legwork for me.
Yeah. Sure, Darren, true story.
Darren, do you know, Darren, I've got messages from Dermot in the past saying, John, is the moon out tonight? Come on. And all he used to do was look out the window,
Dad.
But so there's different things when it comes to planning for astrophotography. First thing is your location, where you're going to go. Now, preferably, if you can get to that location during the daytime, it does help. Okay, because there's nothing as bad as rocking up to a place for the first time at nighttime with your torch. Okay, so ideally, if you're in a position to go there during the day, go do a recce on the place, get your composition more or less what you'd like to have. Therefore, when you turn up in the evening time, it is that bit easier. You also need to look at your weather conditions. You know, there's no point going out there if there's a blanket of cloud out there. Why drive an hour, 45 minutes, an hour to a location, get there, there's a blanket of cloud, when you could have easily checked a radar before you left. And the moon, as we were just joking about there, ideally we don't want a moon in the sky because that's just one big light source. So, you know, you check your moon phases, check is when it's set. That does help big time. Maybe there's some events going on in the sky with meteor showers and so on. Yes, Dermot?
So, like, obviously the moon is going to be covered for, like, what? Is it? How many days is the moon covered for?
I don't know. There's a cycle there that you won't see it for about a week or so, I think.
Let's just say three days if the moon is covered for. Is there a point where the moon is showing that you can still shoot and still see the stars? Like, do you know, would you see a quarter of a moon? Is that okay to shoot in?
Yeah, I would think so too. But also that the moon normally will set as well at that time. Like, I think at the moment the moon is setting at, 1:30 a.m.?
Okay.
You know, now there's no moon out there tonight. But last week the moon was setting around that time. But there's plenty of apps out there which we'll touch on to check the moon phases, when it's there, when it rises, when it sets. But I have shot the Milky Way with a quarter of a moon, Dodd, once it's not in line. That answers your question, hopefully.
Okay, yeah, perfect.
Yeah. The apps that I would use, and if you want to jump in here, please feel free, is TPE. Darren, come on, you're the intelligent one of the three of us. The photographers.
Empress.
Come on, Darren, you can do it. Good man.
Sorry, can you say that again, please? M what?
Well, I used to call it the photographer's epidermis, which is actually what the outside of your skin is called. And the funny thing is when I'd be out with people and I talk about that, they knew exactly what I was talking about, because nobody could pronounce it either, but the actual pronunciation is the empress.
Empress, very good.
Or TPE for short.
Yeah, TPE. We won't ask you to spell it tonight. That at the moment is an app that can be purchased for $899. Okay, so you can do your conversions, but it works at $899. I have that a long time. I love it. There is a night mode feature on that, which I use to plan my shots, basically. You know, it shows the Milky Way, shows where the core is, the extent of the galaxy core is rising, when it's setting. It's a really, really good app. We'll talk about apps in another podcast, but for now, that one really, really is good. Photopills is another good app that I use. Now, I use Photopills mainly when I'm on location. And that is coming in as €10.99 at the moment. Great app. If you're somewhere, I don't know, if you happen to be driving past an abandoned cottage someday during the day and you think, oh, I wonder what that's like going to be like for a Milky Way, you can literally hold that your phone up, see the cottage on your screen, and then you can adjust your time of day to see where the stars will come into play. Now, there's a load of features on Photopills. Again, we haven't got time tonight to go into that, but it will be another feature. AccuWeather, for obvious reasons, for the weather. But one weather app that I use a lot is called Weather Radar, and that's brilliant for cloud cover. Very, very accurate. You know, I'm on the coast here, as you know, and before I hit the coast, I can look at the weather radar and I can see exactly what's coming over. Dermot, do you remember we shot the dolmen on a sunrise there? Was it earlier this year?
I think it was earlier this year, late last year.
And we were, it was raining, it was a mucky morning. We sat into the car, we thought we were going to go home, but remember I opened up the app? That was weather radar.
And you know what, it's funny that you said it, because it gave us like literally a half an hour window before the rain casts. And we nailed it. We absolutely nailed these shots. They're so awesome.
Well, that was extremely accurate. That's a great little... So that app is called Weather Radar and it's free. Okay, I'm sure there's in-app purchase, but I don't use them. It's free.
Yeah.
So how do we take a shot? So again, like, let's, you know, there's people listening to here now and hopefully they're still tuned in. It's
why wouldn't this still be tuned in? We're amazing.
It's an introduction to astrophotography. We want to be able to take our shot. What settings do we use? Okay, but the first thing I will say is, don't be afraid to make the mistakes. I made a load of mistakes when I was trying to shoot it for the first time. I never let it put me off. I learned from my mistakes.
I thought you were always amazing, John. Jesus.
No.
That's just me.
The person who I tell you what, boys, the person who thinks they know it all, that's the person who might as well stop.
Oh,
okay, because nobody knows.
I know a few of those, and especially when it comes to astrophotography, that they've been doing it a wet week and they start telling everybody how it should be done. Well, actual fact, you've shown them and told them how to start off, but 2 months later, they tell you how it should be done. Those experts are my favourite.
I have a funny feeling who it is.
Oh, yeah. I'd say it's not that hard to guess. But yeah, you know what? I think, look, we touched on it there a second ago. I think there's lots of people out there that are experts, inverted commas. Yeah? I mean, look, you don't need to be an expert to understand how to take a photo of the night sky. What you need to do, as you say, John, quite rightly, is try it. Make mistakes. See how it turns out. You know, you can get a shot and looking and going, oh, yeah, that's amazing. How did I do that? to look at your settings on the camera, and then you'll be able to figure out how. Or listen to a podcast like this, and we'll give you the basics, and then you can go out and try and practice it yourself. Yeah. But you got to get out and practice. You got to get out and do it. But more importantly, you got to make mistakes, because you can't get better unless you make mistakes. But actually, if you can accept that you've made a mistake and not beat yourself up about it and get frustrated, like we would have discussed in previous episodes of the podcast, then you can push on through that and you'll just get better and better and better.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to accept your mistakes. Yeah, work away there, Dermot.
So I'd love to give an example there of mistakes and learning how to shoot Astro. Before I went out shooting Astro with John, which was kind of like my first taste of good Astro photography, I was out in Kilkee up the Dunleaky Walk, and then I was there with Trish, and the two of us were sitting on the side of a cliff, and the stars are just amazing. I was shooting away, and on the back of the camera, and it was just a small LCD, and the pictures were coming out, well, what I thought were absolutely drop dead gorgeous, amazing. Now the white balance is off, but that's fine, you can fix that in post if you're shooting in RAW. But I came home and stuck him up on the computer, and I nearly cried, because the whole reason why I went down there at that time of night was to photograph the stars, and everything was out of focus, do you know? But yeah, when I looked in the back of the camera, they looked like they're in focus, and Trish was like, oh my God, they're amazing. But she hasn't a clue anyway, but still. she hasn't a clue about photography. Sorry, I'll rephrase that. She knows a lot of things about different things, but not photography. But like, it just... my heart sank when I saw the pictures, you know, as they're going. I put in so much time and effort, but obviously not enough time, because they're all out of focus, and I just literally had to bin them. But I learned a valuable lesson that night, you know, and that's, I learned from my mistake, you know.
You learned from your mistake, and you never gave up.
No, not at all. Why would you give up?
Absolutely. So what I'm going to do now is that I'm going to, like, let's just put ourselves in the position. Let's just imagine now, let's take ourselves away from the computers now. Three of us are together. We're up in the middle of the Burren or whatever, up by the cliffs, and we're taking a shot. The first thing is, okay, is our composition. We need to have an idea of our composition. Ideally, when we're taking the photograph of the Milky Way, we'd like something in the foreground, be it a tree or an old house, something that brings you into the scene. And we can use our light source then, as I mentioned earlier, which is your lamp, to help you find this. And we can, there's other ways of highlighting that foreground interest as well. Focusing on infinity is a huge thing, as you said earlier, Darren. Some cameras are set to, some lenses are set to infinity, but they're not actually accurate. One little tip that we can give there is to have your friend, whoever's with you on the night, stand 100 feet more away, holding the light, focusing on that till it's pin sharp, and that'll lock you in on infinity. Maybe you want to mark your lens.
What about manual focus? Would you not be better off just manual focus and just focus on the stars and then zoom in, and then once you nail the star, you know, that's what I do.
That's the same. It's the same.
Not both of them are right. It's just,
yeah, I've actually focused it on the lamppost at the end of the road before I've gone out, to get me full infinity.
That's an odd one now.
Yeah.
Do you tape it down then?
I put a little bit of mark. I put a bit of Tippex then on my lens if I needed to, if it was just slightly off the infinity mark.
I've heard of people putting insulating tape on it as well after they found it, so that it never moves out. Just get a Takina. Okay. Bang.
yeah, exactly. Shooting in RAW, you've touched that there, Dad. Yeah, RAW is very important. Always shooting RAW. Set your camera to manual mode and put your ISO maybe to a starting point of 1600. Okay. I would often put it there, depends on how dark the area is, but 1600. My aperture is open up at 2.8. A lot of people maybe who are starting out into the astrophotography, the photography journey, won't have a lens that goes that wide open. It might go to f4. It doesn't mean you can't take a photograph. It might mean you have to raise your ISO to get more light in there. But still, it's not something that you should shy away from. Shutter speed then, anything from 25 to 30 seconds, depending on the type of camera you're using. If you have that, your ISO, your shutter is wide open, or your aperture is wide open, and your shutter speed 25 to 30 seconds, you should have something coming on the back screen of your camera, in a nutshell. There's a lot of tweaking, there's a lot of learning to be done from there. But on those settings, basically with my shutter speed and my aperture, I will only adjust my ISO after that. Reason I'm saying shutter speed is because there is a rule in astrophotography, and it's called the 500 rule. Are you aware of that, lads?
Yeah.
I thought it's a 600 rule, to be honest, John. Yeah. Why I thought that, you'll never know.
500 rule. So basically, this is it's a simple formula that's used to calculate the exact shutter speed with a particular lens, full frame, or a crop sensor camera. And once done, it just gives you pin sharp images. How do we take it? And how do we get the rule? Well, basically, I'm going to read this out to you because I actually took this off the internet earlier. You take the number 500 and then divide it by the focal length of your lens. The longest exposure before the stars start to trail or blur. So for example, if you're taking a shot with a 16mm lens on a full frame camera, that's 500 divided by 16 gives you 31.25 seconds, but just round that off to 30 seconds. And that gives you your correct exposure for using that lens. It does change if we're using a crop frame sensor. So on a Sony and a Nikon, they're a 1.5 crop factor.
Nikon or Nikon?
So basically... Oh, whatever
Nikon.
You like, Darren.
Nikon.
Okay.
I say Nikon because I think I'm a Yank anyway, so...
Nikon. Sorry, John.
Sony or Nikon. Sorry, John. Okay, sorry, moving John. On, sorry, boys. So 1.5 crop factor. Okay, so that's 1.5. Multiply that by 16 equals 24. So then you divide 500 by 24, which will give you 20 seconds if using a Sony or a Nikon or a Nikon crop factor. Okay,
I'm lost now. Okay, so I have a 20mm Sigma Art lens there, right? So what am I doing? Full frame camera.
So divide 500 by 20.
Okay, 500 divided by 20 equals 25.
So that will give you 25 seconds, should be a sufficient amount of time for your exposure to get before your stars start to trail.
Okay,
keep them
perfect.
Pin sharp. You with me? So this is all based on trying to get a pin sharp photograph. For Canon users, for a Canon crop sensor, it's slightly different. It's a 1.6 crop factor. So again, you multiply, this is based on the 16 to 35 lens. Multiply your 1.6 by 16, it gives you 25. 500 divided by 25 will give you 20 seconds. Okay?
Awesome.
So if anybody wants to kind of get that in more depth, they can just Google very easily the 500 rule for astrophotography. So guys, I'm going to wrap this up there now. Unless there's any input you want to give to somebody who's starting out in their astrophotography journey other than go out and enjoy themselves, because it is something that is great fun. And when you do get that first photograph, there is a bit of a wow factor to it and a sense of achievement too.
I'd just like to add in just my favorite lens for astrophotography. I bought a Sigma Art 20mm and it's a 1.4 aperture, so I can open that up. And that means I'm not raising my ISO, so it's a lot cleaner image. And this is my go-to lens for landscape photography. And it's just, I recommend that lens to whether you're a beginner or advanced or whatever, a professional. I think it's just so awesome. So that's all I wanted to say.
What's it again there, Dermot? What is it again?
The Sigma Art 20mm 1.4.
Yeah, excellent. Super. Well, listen, guys, I'm going to wrap it up there now. Thanks for the chat, and we're going to have a word from our sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Hainel Industries. Hainel Industries is one of the leading manufacturers of power products for camcorders and digital cameras. Having celebrated over 50 years in business, Hainel have an excellent reputation in research and development and a well-known history of quality products and excellent design.
Welcome back there, guys. Now we're going to move on to our street photography section of today's podcast. Now, street photography is something that I have done in the past and I actually quite enjoy it. But, you know, it's a difficult thing to do. It's not the easiest thing to do. There's a lot of fear involved in it. And I'm going to just ramble through a few points that I put down today, both my own points and some stuff I took off the web as well, to try and kind of highlight street photography. And, you know, if anybody has an interest, if they're listening in, how it might help them as well to get out there and shoot in the street photography. But before I start, have you boys ever done street photography? And if so, do you like it? If you haven't done it, that's fine too. And maybe we can all learn from discussing this over the next few minutes. Over to you there, Darren. Have you touched on this before, Darren?
Yeah, as I said at the intro, I've never really done it. I did it once, all right. I got one nice shot, I think. It's not something that I'm really attracted to doing, but I can see the attraction of it. But yeah, I think you have to have a certain type of personality to be able to do street photography and be comfortable with it. But what I have seen and what I have learned from watching others, and I've watched a lot of people who are quite good, is you have to be smart. You got to look at your scene. You got to, you know, pick your scene for what it is, and then wait for somebody that's going to enter that scene to complement it, to make the image, tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And what about you, Dermot? Have you touched on this before?
Yeah, I've done it quite a bit through college, to be honest, yeah. Because there's a friend of mine in college, Lucas Lenchowski. Okay, he is probably my favorite street photographer of all time. He is absolutely amazing. You can check him out in 500px. What's that? Flickr. Yeah. So Lucas Lenchowski. We'll put a link up on the Facebook page. But he is just immense. He's absolutely fantastic. So I tried it a couple of times with him. So I was using a 70 to 200 with a teleconverter on it. So I was shooting at 400 mil because I was afraid of getting beaten up by someone, you know, wanting money for their photographs or something. I just didn't have the confidence that he had. And he just had this aura about him that it was just effortless for him. It's like landscape photography to one of us. Like, it's just, we just rock up and do what we do. The street photography is like that to him. He just walks up, cruises the street in Limerick, just goes boom, 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 boom. And all of a sudden, he's got like five awesome shots, and I haven't even taken my camera out of my bag yet. He's that good at it, like, you know.
Absolutely. And when you see those photographs, you kind of, those guys are very inspirational, because it is a tricky subject to do. I have done it in the past myself. I have enjoyed it, but you know, funny enough, and it's probably a fear thing, I've done it more when I'm away, as in out of my own country, when I'm traveling, more so than I would do in my own city. I don't know what kind of sense that makes at all, but that's just how it is for me. I think it's more of a fear thing, but I'll touch on that later on. But, you know, street photography just doesn't have to be done out in the street. We can take it in the, you know, we could take it in a shopping center. We could be at a beach, although you'd have to be careful if you're at a beach. You could always take shots on the bus or in any public areas you want. And generally, it's done candidly. Now, what I mean by that is it's done without permission and without knowledge of your subjects. So, like, and, you know, that's how you capture the emotion and the humanity in people when you're taking your subjects on the street. But the most important thing at the end of the day is to be creating a powerful, compelling and emotional image. And that's what your buddy is doing, Dermot. He's out there. He's catching powerful images because he's very comfortable doing it as well. To take the best camera, I suppose, that you could say for street photography. Well, one, it's the camera that you have on you. That's the cliche saying, by all means. But really, is it? I personally would rather look at using a small camera, you know.
Why
is, you know, it you know, it doesn't require you to think when shooting as well. Like, you know, you have to be fairly quick off the mark when you're shooting it. You have to remember you're going to be carrying it to places to go, and you don't want to bring unwanted attention to yourself as well.
Yeah, like Lucas shoots now on a Sony A7R Mark I, but he uses a 50mm lens only. It's nice and tight, and it's just very good at it, like, you know.
Absolutely. Like, you know, you don't want to feel awkward around people, or, you know, don't be conscious of that as well. Now, I would use the on the street photography. I've done this in markets, and it worked out very, very well for me. Was my Canon G7X Mark II, because it's a great little camera. You know, it's got features of DSLR. Now, it's not a DSLR, but it does just as good as a job in certain aspects of it, and it is a great little camera for shooting. Out on the street. I have used my Canon 6D, but when I've used it, I've used my 24-105 lens, because you know, it can get wide and it can zoom in close as well. So there are two cameras that I have used in the past, but the first thing and foremost is I have never wanted to bring attention towards myself, because it does make me feel quite uncomfortable as well.
Well, actually, can I just jump in there, John, on one point, which was, I remember reading something on some social media page. It was about a guy who said that he was so good at street photography, he could take a picture of somebody, capture their emotion, and they would never know they'd done the image. In fact, they'd never know he had a camera.
Brilliant.
And I was intrigued. And I read on, and what he did was quite good. He had a GoPro, he had a chest harness, and he had the remote control.
Wow.
He'd stand there, 2 feet away from you, put the remote control in his pocket, he presses the button, the GoPro takes the image, bang. Because it's such a wide angle as well, he captures a lot within the scene. Okay, granted, you're not going to be able to get up close, but if you're walking up close, you got that image. So that, I thought, was quite ingenious.
Excellent. And type of GoPro is he using? Like, is the quality good? Is it going to be bad? Is it good? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, he was using the GoPro Hero 4.
Okay, it's some bit decent, so, okay.
So that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
That reminds me, Darren, as well, when I was away, and I'll talk about this in a few moments, but have you ever heard the term shooting from the hip? Have you ever heard that?
Yeah.
You know, and that is a great...
With a gun.
It's a great skill to be able to do it. And it also gives you a completely different perspective on your on the image as well. But I'm going to now look at what makes a good street photo. Have any of you ever heard of the famous photographer, Dodd, you might have come across this in your college, Henri Cartier-Bresson?
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
No?
Yeah. I did,
Yeah. He was a famous, he was probably the earliest practitioner of street photography, and he came up with the saying, the decisive moment. It's a bit like the Kodak moment. So for anybody who's wondering who he is a French photographer, and he's known in street photography as being the godfather of street photography. He also would have taken 10 to 30 shots of a single image back in those days. And I think we're going back, you know, back into the 1930s maybe. And so from 1930s or 40s or 50s, one of you probably can Google that there when I mention him. But yeah, he used to shoot 10 to 30 photos of an image and then he'd wait and select his favorite one. But he was the one guy that really brought street photography to its to the core, really. Like, and he's really, really good. And I would highly recommend you looking him up. I was reading about him earlier. And some of his images that he took back in the day on film camera were absolutely outstanding. That brings me on to camera settings. Now, this is a personal choice of mine. I would shoot in shutter priority on a Canon for when I'm shooting street photography.
Why is that?
The reason being is I want to be able to freeze any movement at any given time. Now, I have, in times, left my auto ISO on as well, so I would have one less thing to worry about. But I would normally keep my shutter speed at 1/125th of a second. 125th of a second, or how do you pronounce that? Darren, come on, Darren, you're the clever one. How do you pronounce that?
125th
of a second. I would leave it at that normally when I'm shooting street photography, because it kind of freezes the images for me. If I was shooting in aperture priority, fine, but if the light went low, I may not get that sharp image that I wanted. So a little bit like sports photography, I shoot in a shorter priority when I'm on the streets. Again, that's just my preference. Location, yeah? Work away there.
Shooting out 1/125th of a second, that's a slow enough shutter speed. I'd be afraid to shoot at that at a wedding because I'd be afraid of getting blur, especially if a subject is moving towards me from, like, you know, not side to side, literally from a far distance towards me, to say, right? So, like, if a bride is walking up the aisle, I'd have my shutter speed at least 500 a second. I'd be afraid of having it that low because... In. Okay.
Yeah, it's always depends on the situation you're in. I shot in China now and I left it at that a lot. I was actually only looking back at my photographs the other day and I got some really nice shots out of it, but I do get that point there, man. It's very, very valid. Moving on to location and planning, this is a big thing because you have to make sure it's safe and you have to also make sure it's legal where you are. Now, I'm going to touch on a little bit of a piece on the legal side of things towards the end of this podcast, just for anybody who's interested in it. Light and time of the day. It's a bit like your landscape photography, you know. It's important to know what your light is like, how strong your light is going to be. But one way I would look at that is quantity of light is better than quality of light. And again, that goes down to knowing that you're going to have a shutter speed selected. Does that make any sense? Kind of.
Almost definitely, no. Would you shoot in, like, I would reckon broad daylight would be much better than a low light, like the sun setting for street photography, would it be? Because you're not looking for those pastel colours in the sky, more or less, would you?
Well, I suppose it depends on the photographer and what they're kind of looking to achieve, really. Like, you know, if you're going in later in the day or in the morning, you're going to get your lovely shadows as well. So it does depend.
Okay.
Anytime I have done it, I have done it during broad daylight, being honest with you.
Yeah, I'm... Ditto. I was the same. Darren, what about you? When you tried it, was that early morning or was it an evening or?
Oh, no. It's during the day. Sure, look, you're looking for street photography. It's only mad people like photographers that are up at the crack of dawn.
I will tell you, Dermot, I have a few lovely scenes, street scenes that I took at night time, but when I fixed it on a static image and I let the cars or the movement come around it, and they work quite well. I've asked people to stand still, maybe read a magazine or read a map as still as they can, and I check my exposure that little bit longer just to get a bit of movement behind it, just to give some sort of story to the scene, and that works out quite well. But I've only ever been able to do that in the evening time. Here's a word for you boys: juxtaposition. Have you ever heard of that in terms of street photography? J-U-X-T-A position.
I have heard of it, but I can't remember why, to be totally honest, Jim.
It's basically a fancy word for contrast.
No, I've never heard of it. I genuinely thought I heard it before, but the fact that you said it's to do with contrast, I've no idea. I heard juxtaposition from something else.
It's when you put two different elements in a frame that directly contradict one another. So, for example, if you had a grandmother standing sight next to the grandchild, or yeah. if you had a red shirt in front of a green background, that would be called juxtaposing as well.
If that like was called red words. And green should never be seen, but yeah. yet they're opposite in the color wheel.
But it's also that's just one terminology that is used in street photography, just the way we'd use different terminology in our landscape photography. Emotion's a big thing as well. Attention to detail. So, you know, it's not all about getting the full body shot of somebody walking down the street. It's lovely to get a shot of somebody's hands, especially, you know, an elderly person. It's getting their photographs of hands holding something, maybe just shows the detail in it. What else have you got? You can do urban landscape as well.
So is it better to photograph old people in street photography? They're more of a character. Yeah. They're more definition in their face.
I think so, wrinkles. Too. I yeah. think so, too. Yeah, yeah. It gives more. It tells more of a story, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely feel that way anyway.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to mention this, okay? And we're not going to stay on this because this can be quite controversial. We haven't got time for this tonight. But some people have a big thing about photographing the homeless, okay? And, like, when you photograph a homeless person, it can give a cracking image as well. But it can be quite controversial for some people. I don't know. Do you want to give your thoughts on that in 30 seconds? Thought on that?
I will, because if they're in a pub, I feel if they're in a public place, you can take a photograph of them. And if someone wants to get controversial or get ratty about it, well, so be it. I'm allowed to photograph wherever I want as long as it's in a public place. So that's my two cents on it. I'm not being an asshole. I'm just telling the truth.
Yeah. What about you, Darren?
That's where we differ. I disagree with that.
Okay. What's your thoughts?
The fact that you're in a public place does not automatically give you the right to be taken a photograph of and use that photograph elsewhere. There's privacy.
It's not privacy. I'm in a public place. I can take a photograph.
Does it mean that you can't take a photograph of me?
I can.
And you can't use it without my permission.
No, I can't use it in an advertisement way. I can't make money off your photograph, but I am allowed to use it in an artistic way. I can use your photograph. By taking a photograph of you on the street, I can use it in an art gallery. But as long as I don't sell it, I can use it wherever I want.
Hang on a sec. Absolutely not. Okay.
Yes, I can.
Absolutely
lads,
not.
I said 30
no
seconds
way
each.
Can you do that. Okay, hang on. Let me. Okay. I'll sum this up in 10 seconds, right. Okay? Dad, I'm on the street. It's my life. You take a photo of me and you put it up on Facebook or whatever it may be. It shows me in a position that I may not want to be in or shown in.
Okay.
So, Dad,
And you have a right to do that?
I have.
Absolutely no way.
I do.
Okay, I'm going to...
No, you don't.
Lads, I'm going to pull you in there now for a second. To sum that up there, okay? Because I loved a bit of controversy, guys. It's great. The moral of that story is, Dad...
I'll fight you later, Darren.
Don't take a bloody photograph of Darren, okay? But yeah, lads, look, that is great. And that's why I wanted to bring that in, because that's a whole different ball game. It's a whole different discussion that we could have on that. But it is a controversial element, for sure.
No way.
Fear is a big thing. I've had a fear of doing street photography. One, and I'm going to be completely honest with you, the confidence of taking a photograph. Like, I do think it when you're out doing street photography. Okay, I've taken shots of people walking down the street for me, or they're in the distance, they're walking towards me. They might be walking away from me. It gives me a nice little photograph. But if there was somebody there and I saw, like, even if it was a homeless person or it was an elderly person and I thought they made for a good photograph, I would actually ask for permission. And I would tell them why I'm taking the photograph. I might even show them a business card if they thought, is this guy serious or not? But if there was a situation where I thought permission needed to be asked, I certainly would, for two reasons. One, showing her a bit of respect to the person you're taking your photograph of. And two, it makes me more comfortable when I'm actually taking the photograph. And I have done that in the past. And I have asked people for permission to take the photograph and they said no. And I have said, that's fine. And off he went on to the next person and so on. So yes, I'm not going to ask permission for everybody walking down the street if it's a full on, but if it's an actual kind of a portrait or a street portrait that you're stopping somebody, if it's an artist on the side of the street playing his instrument, I would ask, can I take your photograph? And normally they would oblige. I will touch back on that in two seconds. But the other part of the fear for me is, unfortunately, nowadays, and we're seeing so much of it, is getting attacked and getting your gear stolen off you. And there are, unfortunately, some places that I will not go to photograph on the streets for that very reason. And like I'm sure there are many people who are listening to this podcast as well. So I do know one person who was confronted with a knife and was asked for the gear. And so, you know, it's not a nice thing to happen. So it's one area that has put me off for street photography. So now I choose my planning a lot more careful around the areas I would go and the subjects that I'm going to go after. I don't know what you think of that, boys.
So that's why it makes sense to have a camera with a smaller lens.
Yeah, so
it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb.
Like, you don't want to be drawing attention to yourself. I'll just give you two quick one funny story. I presume I can say this in this podcast. But when I was in China there a few years ago, I was doing the street photography in China. It's absolutely brilliant. But we also felt like we were getting our photograph taken nonstop. My daughter, she's long blonde hair. She was only 7 at the time. Constantly getting her photograph taken. It was like you said, Darren, it was very, very annoying. I was quite worried about where her photograph was going to go. I'm sure it's up on social media somewhere. I'm sure it's on YouTube because they're doing videos as well. But I got to a stage when I saw a camera coming, I'd put my hand up in the face of the person and I would say, ask her for permission first. She'd always say no, and I'd make sure that they'd turn and walk away. And that's why I asked for permission myself when I get the photographs. But there was one particular incident I had in China, it's actually quite funny and scary at the same time, was we're at a fish market. I was in my element taking photographs. If you can imagine the scene, one side of the harbour where we were on was, they were bringing the fish up, I suppose, to the poorer markets. And as you walked around the harbour, they were bringing the same boat were bringing to the fish into the shops. But there was a lovely big boat, a Navy SEALs boat there out there. And I thought, this would be great. Chinese boat, take a photograph of the Chinese Navy boat. Took a photograph. Moments later, I'm walking through the market, I turned around and I saw 5 or 6 Chinese Navy officers marching straight towards me, pointing the finger. Now, I was very naive. I had my
run, Forrest, run!
I had my 7200 2.8 that I just bought a few days beforehand, hanging out of my 6D. All I was thinking, I've got money here, they're going to arrest me, they're going to take my camera off me. So, yes, I done a Forrest Gump on it, and I ran into the market area where the lads were throwing up the fish from the boats. It was 5 minutes of hell for me, but you know what? The buzz was immense. But unfortunately, I never went back down to that pier because I thought they'd be looking for me. But the moral of the story is, be careful where you shoot. And be you know, respectful for people you are taking photographs of. I have photographing in public places. I looked it up, the legal end of things today. Now, this is not discussion, boys, okay? Because I know you're only going to start baiting the head off each other for this one, right? So if you want to read up on this, digitalrights.ie, Ireland. This is Digital Rights Ireland. The website is digitalrights.ie. In here, here's a paragraph, very short. Photographs in a public place. You're not allowed to harass people in the course of your photography. Stalking somebody or repeatedly blocking their way to take a photograph of them could be construed as harassment. Simply taking a photograph of them probably won't. Taking photographs of people in public is generally allowed. However, an exception is made where the subject would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. You're perfectly entitled to take a photograph of someone walking down the street, but hiding in a tree or taking a photograph of them in their home may get you into trouble. So that brings me back to saying permission. If you see somebody standing on the street, I would ask for permission. If it's general people walking through your street and you want to get a nice candid photograph, work away. But just respect their...
Well, John, that's the greatest description of legality-wise. There's so many loopholes in that description. It's crazy. So I can see Darren's point of view. Yes, I still want to dig the head off him. Yes. But from my point of view as well, I can see my point as well, but it doesn't answer anyone's question there, or it doesn't answer Darren's side, it doesn't answer my side. It's very great.
You have to remember, that's the Digital Rights Ireland crowd putting that into their website. But I have heard, I'm not going to go into this because I don't know the facts of it, but I have actually heard there's now some states in America, you're not allowed to take a photograph on the street. It's against the law. So hopefully there might be somebody listening to this podcast from overseas who might be able to post something on our Facebook page to let us know how it works in their area. But guys, I am going to wrap that up. That was an interesting topic. I'm sure we could talk about it further and get very controversial on it in the future. But we will wrap it up. And I'm going to move on to the VSP for this evening. Do you know what our VSP stands for? For anybody who's listening to the podcast for the first time. The usual. Darren, very
solid.
Right, so
a very solid product. I have chosen tonight the Canon G7X Mark II as the very solid product, purely based on the podcast I just spoke about. It can be used in your astrophotography. It's brilliant for using making videos of star trails, and it can also be used as a lovely little camera for shooting the streets as well. I know there's somebody here on this podcast that uses the Canon G7X Mark II for his vlogging. And Darren, you might just give us again. Now, I'm going to keep you to time because I'm conscious of time here. But give us, say, 1 minute or even 50 seconds of why you love the G7X Mark II so much.
Okay, I use the G7X for my vlogging. You're absolutely right. The reason I love it so much is because it's small, it's compact, the clarity is phenomenal. The autofocus with the Canon dual pixels is superb. It has the screen that I can flip up. It's a touch screen. Never had an issue since I started to use it. The battery life is phenomenal on it. Couple of reasons why I mainly moved to it was, from a vlogging point of view, I had a previous camera. We touched on it in a previous episode of this podcast, which was the DJI Osmo Plus. Thought it'd be brilliant, thought it'd be fantastic. Problem was, the focal length was 1 meter minimum, so it was no good from a vlogging point of view. So I moved to the Canon G7X. Since I moved, I haven't had an issue. It's been spot on. Only disadvantage that I found with it, but it's actually become an advantage, is that you have no auxiliary mic input. The mic that's on it is quite good. It's actually, I've recorded a couple of episodes just using that mic alone, and it's been surprisingly good, except if you've got heavy winds, then obviously the wind will take over on that. So then I'll be able to use an external recorder, which is the Zoom H1, and that's really, really good. But that then, like I said, has an advantage because I no longer have to be tied to the camera. So if I was at a plug-in mic, I'd have one or two options. From a vlogging point of view, I can use it just to plug in a cable, I'm going to be tied into it, or I can get a wireless version, which again would plug in, but I'm restricted in regards to the distance that I can go. Whereas with the Zoom H1, I did an episode when I was in Snowdonia. I was at an island on Anglesey. I walked around 40 meters away. I used the G7X on full zoom right into the lighthouse. I was talking, walking around the lighthouse, and the audio has been recorded separately. The video has been done by the Canon G7X. Brilliant camera, phenomenal features, big features of a big camera on such a small unit.
Absolutely.
I swear by it. I love it. I've taken photos with it. I went on another episode of my vlog where I just went purely scouting, and all I had was the G7X. I got video, I got images, which were a good quality, 24 megapixels, correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, all round phenomenal camera, fits in your pocket, massive.
Absolutely, it's a great little camera. And the couple things I love about it is, now I don't use it as much as you do, is the tilt-up touchscreen. I love that feature. I use it when I'm recceiving my shots. When I go out into the landscape or anywhere, I might take that out of my bag first, just like the way I might take out my phone as well. It's a great little camera, absolutely all around great. But you summed it up, Darren. Just to give us an idea of cost of that at the moment, in Whelan's here in Limerick, it's coming in at $649. In Conn's Cameras up in Dublin, it's actually coming in at $649 as well. And however, in Barker Photography in Cork is actually coming in at $699. I do stand corrected. They are the prices that were on their websites when I was looking up today. They may have changed since. But that is, so if you are looking for, as you said, Darren, a really good big camera in a small case, basically, that is a great camera to go by doing. So lads, I am going to leave it there for today. It was absolutely brilliant talking to you. Hopefully those who have listened in may be a little bit inspired to go out and take the first astrophotography photograph. And if you do, you might drop a photograph or drop a post on our Facebook page as well to let us know how you got on and if there's anything else that you need us to help you with. Also the street photography, same thing. Anybody listening in, gone out, take a few street photography, or if you're an expert in that area and you'd like to share your ideas with us on our Facebook page, please do share your images as much as we can, as we do love them. Lads, it's been great. It's been controversial. Love yous every week, and I will talk to you next week. Talk to you, boys. Thanks again.
See you, John. Have a good one. See you, Darren.
See you, John. See you, Dad. Schlange fall, guys.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed the Irish Photography Podcast, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, guys, keep shooting.